Palestine,
but they were surprised that our forces targeted them. This is also a message that the American-British aggression has failed to limit the capabilities of the Yemeni army.
Following the Yemeni naval attacks, the US and UK carried out a fresh round of airstrikes against several positions in the capital Sana'a and other cities. US officials said the attack was carried out using F-18 fighter jets launched from an American military base in Bahrain.
Observers highlight that the Yemeni naval operations go beyond displaying military strength, rather seen as a humanitarian, ethical and religious duty to stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people. They assert that Western aggression will not dissuade Yemeni naval attacks, which are expected to cease only when Israel halts its genocidal war in Gaza. عبد اللطيف الوشلي صنعاء.
Islamic Revolution and Scientific Leap. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. The glorious Islamic Revolution of the Iranian people in 1979 has, based on the enlightening instructions of Islam, acquisition and teaching of knowledge have been highly emphasized in Islam. Accordingly, after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, very great progresses have been made, both in eradication of illiteracy and higher education. During the despotic Pahlavi regime, there were some 155,000 university students, while the number has increased to over 4 million, so that today, 25% of people are graduates of universities. Moreover, Iran's scientific ranking has promoted remarkably. Now, in spite of all-out sanctions, which have been illegally and cruelly imposed by the US and its European accomplices, Iran's speed in the field of production of knowledge is 11 times more than the global average. Today, in the seventh episode of the special series, on the 45th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, we are going to touch upon Iran's scientific breakthroughs. Hope you'll enjoy it. The Islamic Republic presently produces nearly 2% of knowledge and stands at the 17th position in the world. After the Islamic Revolution, many companies have been founded whose axis of activity is to work on sciences and technologies. These companies are aimed at growing and accelerating economic advancement via modern technologies. Approximately 10,000 knowledge-based companies have been set up in Iran. With regards to high emphasis which is put on the expansion of such companies, it is expected to increase their number and impact in the domestic economy. These companies not only play a significant role in domestic production, but also it is forecast that till the end of the current Iranian year, March 19th, the rate of their exports will amount to $2 billion. One of the newest scientific phenomena in the world is nanotechnology, which creates basic changes in molecules and atoms to achieve more applications and qualities of elements. The Islamic Republic of Iran ranks first in the region and fourth in the world in this modern science. There are 350 companies active in the field. These companies have managed to make numerous products which are used mainly in textile, agriculture, petrochemicals, medicine, and home appliances. With respect to the rapid growth of nanotechnological products, it is estimated to export around $1 billion till the end of the next year. The Islamic Republic of Iran has made great breakthroughs in stem cells, which is considered a great development on medicine. Iran stands at 13th position in the field globally. Stem cells are susceptible to ample proliferation and transformation to different tissues of body. This enables them to repair and reconstruct tissues. So far, important measures have been taken in the fields of implantation of brain, bone, skin, cornea, treatment of cancer, repairing of damaged organs, and also making of various medicines. Royan, as the most important research center in Iran, has gained global fame for rendering a variety of medical and pharmaceutical services using stem cells. This advanced center, besides curing of infertility and other surgical operations with stem cells, has been successful in cloning of endangered animal species and empowering of domestic animals against various diseases. Gaining access to the full uranium enrichment circulation for peaceful usages was a great scientific achievement in 2006 for Iran. This important technology has ever since been used in different domains, such as securing energy, improvement of agricultural products, medicine, veterinary medicine, pharmaceuticals, water refinery, etc. Western governments and the Zionist regime, however, have exerted their utmost to deprive Iran from this right with the pretext of the likelihood of making atomic bombs. This while the fake Israeli regime has the largest nuclear arsenal in the region and has not signed a single covenant or pact, including NPT. Another boastful scientific and technological achievement in Iran after the victory of the Islamic Revolution has been the launching of satellites to the space, which places the country at the 9th position in the world. This success becomes more valuable once we know that all phases of making the satellite carrier, and installations of launching, monitoring, and controlling satellites have been done domestically by Iranian scientists. The first Iranian satellite was launched in 2009, and Iran has sent several animals alive to the space. The Islamic Republic has sent 11 satellites to the space, three of which were sent recently on 28th of January 2024. Iran has planned to launch new satellites to higher orbits for research, telecommunication, cartography, meteorology, and discovery of mines.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Like there is another plan on the table of Hamas and Israel to look at the ways to stop the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war. This comes after preliminary discussions between Israel, the U.S., Egypt, Qatar. Hamas has confirmed receiving the proposal. So what exactly does this plan entail? Now, it is noteworthy to point out that this plan was first hashed out by the intelligence chiefs from Israel, the US, and Egypt, as well as the Prime Minister of Qatar, Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdulrahman bin Jassim Al Thani, in Paris. They called it the three-stage truce plan. So, what are the three phases that were hashed out that is supposed to lead to an end of this aggression that would satisfy the demands of both Hamas resistance group and the Israeli regime and its extreme cabinet? The first phase would consist of a pause in fighting and the release of elderly, civilian, and women and children captives. Major deliveries of food and medicine to Gaza would resume. The second phase would see the release of female Israeli regime forces and male recruit regime forces, another increase in aid deliveries, and the restoration of utility services to Gaza. Finally, the third phase would see the release of bodies of deceased Israeli regime forces in exchange for Palestinian prisoners freed. There are preconditions that need to be abided by during each of the phases. Military operations from both sides would have to stop during each phase, a complete stop, something unthinkable at this juncture in time. Another precondition depends on the negotiations when it comes to captive and prisoner releases. The specific number of Palestinian prisoners to be released at each stage will be determined with a focus on those who face long prison sentences. If all goes according to the plan, then the war will end and Hamas will ultimately release male Israeli soldiers in exchange for Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails. Hamas demands for a ceasefire approval don't quite add up to the reported three-stage truce plan. Hamas has previously demanded a permanent ceasefire as a precondition to enter negotiations. It wants guarantees and a plan for rebuilding the enclave. The withdrawal of Israeli regime forces from Gaza is also a demand, with ending the blockade the final demand. But other key resistance officials have also some key demands that doesn't appear the Israeli regime can meet. This is what Ziad al-Nakhale, the Secretary General of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad Movement, has said. A clear political solution that ensures the rights of Palestinians. Or how about Osama Hamdan, senior Hamas representative in Lebanon? He has said, in addition to the Hamas demands, that there needs to be an international recognition of Palestinians' right to self-determination, adding that there needs to be an establishment of an independent Palestinian state with Al-Quds as its capital. Something the Israeli PM and his cabinet have outright rejected. The far-right Israeli minister Itamar Ben-Gvir appeared to suggest that a deal with Hamas would trigger a cabinet collapse and an end to this unity cabinet. In this post on X, he said that a reckless deal would equal a cabinet split. This would mean the end of a unity cabinet. Meanwhile, the tally keeps increasing. Over 27,000 Palestinians murdered and over around 224 Israeli regime forces taken out, although this figure is grossly underreported by the regime. So, as with all truce agreements, this is no exception. It will be a difficult one to achieve, especially given that some of the demands from either side are enough to prevent a truce from happening.
It is known that the Islamic Republic of Iran has stood with the Palestinians and all people resisting Israeli ambitions in the region since the advent of the Islamic Revolution. But the roots of this brotherly love are even deeper than that. During the PLO presence in Lebanon in the 70s, those working for the Islamic Revolution in Iran are believed to have trained directly with Yasser Arafat's chief military commander, Abu Jihad. The centrality of Al-Quds to the Islamic Revolution cannot be underestimated. The proud name of Al-Quds permeates throughout this historical process and is an ever-present mainstay of the state, which has been built since 1979. Imam Khomeini was crystal clear in his assessment of Israeli intrigue in the area. Everyone should realize that the world superpowers' aim to create Israel does not end with the occupation of Palestine, they plan, heaven forbid, extending the fate of Palestine to all Arab countries. The leader of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, Yasser Arafat, was given a hero's welcome in Tehran following the removal of the West-toxicated Shah regime from power. He famously remarked that every Iranian freedom fighter is represented in the Palestinian Revolution. Thanks to these decades of support for all who have sought to protect their societies from Israeli and US domination, there are now two clear axes in the region. The axes of resistance confronts Zionist aggression, and the axes of assistance helps Israel in a multitude of ways. As Saleh Al-Aruri once stated, the Islamic Republic is the only state in the world with a budget specifically for the liberation of Palestine. It is not an overstatement to say there would be no coherent resistance axes in the region today without the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran.
It has been 44 years since the Islamic Revolution in Iran, the popular uprising that toppled the U.S.-backed Pahlavi regime, changing the course of the country's history. Led from exile by Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, the uprising toppled the U.S.-backed despotic monarchy and replaced it with an Islamic Republic, ushering in an era of political freedoms and independence from foreign influence. The revolution brought about significant economic progress to the country. It was made on behalf of the Mostazafin, the downtrodden, who were left behind by the monarchy's uneven development model. In rural areas in Iran, the expansion of health and education led to a clear reduction in poverty. The 1970s poverty rate of 25% dropped to less than 10% in 2014. These social politics, biased in favor of the poor, helped explain why Iran's Human Development Index, HDI, has been relatively positive. Most Iranians today enjoy access to basic services and infrastructure, while the population has almost doubled and most of the country is urbanized. Other measures of social development have similarly improved. Literacy rates has more than doubled, especially among young women, and now encompasses almost all the population. Meanwhile, female students have outnumbered their male counterparts at universities for more than a decade.
The Islamic Revolution, after its victory, managed to change the political geography and geopolitical structure of the region. The credit for this change goes to the nature of the discourse of the Islamic Revolution. The ideological framework and the valuable human content presented by leader of the revolution, Imam Khomeini, may his noble secret be sanctified, as the speaker and founder were able to create a new model and introduce a new composition to the region and the world as a whole. With the victory of the Islamic Revolution, the people of the region realized that they could stand against the West and the East and change the equations. The successive failures of the Zionist entity and the United States of America in the region indicate that the Islamic Revolution was the source of inspiration for the peoples of the world, and especially in West Asia. Certainly, without exaggeration and in a scientific and objective manner, we can say that the period before the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran is not the same as the period after it. At the level of the conflict with the Zionist enemy, 1 year before the revolution, Egypt had signed the Camp David peace agreement with the Zionist enemy, and it was said that time that Egypt's exit from the conflict meant that the conflict with this enemy had ended, and the agreement with Jordan was added to it. Many expected that the resistance against this enemy would end after these agreements, but the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran brought the region into a new equation and into direct conflict with the Zionist enemy. Since the first days of the Islamic Revolution, Iran has clearly stood against the Israeli entity, and as is known, it closed the Israeli entity embassy and turned it into an embassy for the state of Palestine, and stated clearly that this entity is illegitimate and confirmed that it will stand by the legitimate resistance in Palestine, and this was a new equation. No one could have expected it. This seemed to bring about major changes in the resistance movement and in the development of the resistance movement in Palestine and the region of West Asia. The pressures of the U.S. and Zionist Israeli attacks and divisive projects targeting Islamic communities that we witness today are a direct result of the existence of this resistance. If it weren't a strong axis of resistance, the United States wouldn't need to exert these efforts, carry out attacks, and impose sanctions. Therefore, today's confrontation is clear and challenging, especially since the axis of resistance in West Asia has become an essential part of regional and international equations.
The Association for Israel's Soldiers is based in occupied Palestine and claims to be the sole avenue through which donations can be made directly to IOF soldiers and IOF units. These donations come from Zionists in Palestine, as well as from the US, Canada, Brazil, Mexico, France, and the UK. The UK Friends of the Association for the Well-being of Israel Soldiers is a registered charity which is obliged by law to show public benefit. Its charitable objectives include relief of need and suffering, advancement of education, and provision of facilities for recreation of the occupation forces. Guidance published by the Charity Commission states that it is a legal requirement that any detriment or harm that results from charitable purposes must not outweigh the benefit. Perhaps supporting genocide outweighs those purposes. Amongst the trustees of the charity are Colonel Richard Kemp, a former British soldier said to have hateful views on Islam and Muslims. In December, the BBC was criticised for interviewing Kemp without reference to his role as a UK Avis trustee. In one recent interview with a pro-Israel blog, Kemp was quoted as describing the killing of civilians in Gaza as necessary. Palestine Declassified has traced around 20 charities which have donated to UK Avis over the last 15 years. The following are notable donors: Gerald and Gail Ronson Family Foundation, which was created by Gerald Ronson, the convicted fraudster, who runs the Rontec company, operating over 250 BP and Esso service stations in the UK. Ronson also set up the Community Security Trust that runs point of the Zionist regime in the UK. Though one of its charitable objectives mentions opposing extremism, this is yet another example showing that Ronson, in reality, supports extremism and genocide. Loftus Charitable Trust, set up by the Loftus family, which made its money from the watchmaking firm Accurist. It also funds the extremist Zionist sect Shabbat Lebovich, Islamophobic think tanks, Jewish supremacist groups in East Jerusalem, and the Community Security Trust. David and Ruth Lewis Family Charitable Trust, set up by the Lewis family, which own River Island clothing chain. The charity also funds Islamophobic think tank and illegal settlements in East Jerusalem. The Family Foundations Trust, set up by the UK property investor Richard Mintz. The charity has funded the extremist sect Shabbat Lebovich, Islamophobic think tanks, and the Community Security Trust. Richard's son and charity trustee Joshua co-founded the website Friend a Soldier, an online platform where soldiers can become digital ambassadors. UK Avis is already under investigation by the UK charity regulator, the Charity Commission. The investigation should widen to include the nexus of genocide-supporting charities we have revealed. They should be shut down by the Charity Commission.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
The pressure exerted by resistance groups in Iraq on illegal U.S. bases and oil platforms has demonstrated the determination of the resistance front against the U.S. occupation. At the same time, these groups have sent a political message with anti-colonial content to both their fellow citizens and to the United States and its regional allies, particularly the regime in Tel Aviv. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV noted, the attack by the Iraqi Popular Mobilization Forces, PMU, an umbrella group of the Iraqi resistance that is part of the axis of resistance against the U.S. military base on the Syria-Jordan border, left three U.S. troops dead and at least 40 others injured. From the perspective of the axis of resistance, the drone attack on the Tower 22 base served to again highlight that the American presence in the region is not immune to the devastating consequences of the ongoing Israeli genocide in the besieged Gaza Strip. In fact, believing otherwise is a politically naive and analytically shallow proposition. Further, this attack is part of the announced campaign by the leaders of the Axis of Resistance, from Iraq to Syria to Lebanon to Yemen, including Hezbollah leader Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, who has repeatedly emphasized the determination of the resistance forces to expel foreign forces from the region. The PMU, as proponents of the political discourse of this axis of resistance, have aimed to convey the message that the current moderately intense regional war could potentially extend to all American military bases in the Persian Gulf, becoming much more costly for the United States. It's quite naive to expect that troops from countries supporting the ongoing Zionist genocide in the besieged Gaza Strip and deployed in the region will not suffer any kind of harm. On the other hand, it is important to recall that the Iraqi parliament, in an exercise of its political sovereignty, passed a resolution in January 2020 unequivocally urging the government in Baghdad to expel foreign troops from the country. Iraqi officials have in recent months intensified these calls amid a surge in attacks on the U.S. bases in response to the events unfolding in Gaza, where Americans are seen hand-in-glove with the Zionist regime. Let's not forget these same troops were responsible for the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani, the commander of the Quds Force of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, IRGC of Iran, and the deputy leader of the PMU, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, outside the Baghdad airport in January 2020. The attack on the U.S. military base in Jordan should also be considered as part of the response to the assassination of those two leaders of the resistance front, the linchpins of the fight against terrorism. In this context, it is important to note that it was in the aftermath of these extrajudicial killings that Sayyid Nasrullah pledged to punish the United States and expel its troops from the region. From an organizational standpoint, but simultaneously confirming the discursive unity of the axis of resistance, it's interesting to note that the collaboration between Iraqi PMU and Hezbollah in Syria to combat ISIS or Daesh helped create a new category of collective defense that challenges traditional understanding anchored in the Eurocentric version. This collective defense that characterizes the axis of resistance explains how the transnational alliance has formed a military coalition against the Zionist entity and its allies. Notably involved in this coalition are groups such as Hezbollah, Ansarullah, and the Iraqi PMU. All these groups have in recent months practically demonstrated their support for the Palestinian resistance. This coalition of regional forces is based on the solidarities and horizontal affinities that clearly cannot be understood within the hierarchical parameters of Western-centric power dynamics. In other words, the axis of resistance can be characterized as a non-hierarchical and horizontal collaboration. It represents a new model of shared sovereignty between resistance groups scattered across the region. These movements are self-reliant and fully capable of making their own decisions in support of the people and resistance in Palestine, who have reeling under the Zionist killing machine since October 7th. The expulsion of U.S. troops from Iraq must be carried out in collaboration with the rest of the members of the Axis of Resistance to achieve the goal of an autonomous region in political terms. The pressure exerted by resistance groups in Iraq on illegal U.S. bases and oil platforms has demonstrated the determination of the resistance front against the U.S. occupation. At the same time, these groups have sent a political message with anti-colonial content to both their fellow citizens and to the United States and its regional allies, particularly the regime in Tel Aviv. Hence, it can be stated that there is a direct relationship between U.S. support for the Zionist regime genocide in Gaza, the 2020 assassination of top anti-terror commanders General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, and the PMU's attack on the Tower 22 base. The writing is on the wall. Both the American occupation of Iraq and the Israeli occupation of Palestine must end for the axis of resistance to halt its operations against both occupying entities.
Siyutu.
Tümen.
Yani...
Bazaar.
Almost everything around us is either made of plastic or has some plastic component. The use of plastic products in our daily lives is so widespread that many of our regular activities require a wide range of plastic accessories and products. Plastic is everywhere, from our homes to offices, businesses and health centers. It is also used to make aeroplane parts, cars, trains and so much more. Plastic is one of the most widely used materials due to its versatile features, which have boosted economies across the globe.
Well, hello there, and welcome to another edition of Bazaar, the program that analyzes profits, markets, industries, and all sorts of things that connect us nationally and internationally. This week, we are going to take a look at Iran's plastic production. We wanted to see how this market is doing and check out some major players in this sector. We will also peek into some of its contributions to the national economy. Enough said. Let's walk through today's Bazaar.
To become more familiar with plastic products and their production, we visited Parham Plast Arya. This company has been around for many years and is a major contender in the plastic products market. It makes hundreds of plastic-based products for a variety of uses. Some products are household plastic items such as baskets, dishes, utensils, and even larger things like chairs and tables. All things considered, this company provides some of the highest quality products found in the market. This is mainly because of its choice of raw material, which is rigorously tested for quality in its control labs. Moreover, raw materials such as polymers and additives are abundant inside the country. So, it doesn't have to look far for its feedstock. One of the advantages this company has is it controls the whole production and distribution process from design to sales.
In terms of household plastic products, there's always a thirst for newer and more stylish products coming from consumers. So companies must stay on their toes and create new molds each year to offer products that excite customers. However, making new molds is not always easy, and it can be an expensive process. That's why some companies choose to import molds instead, while others develop their own in R&D departments.
This company's research and development division is at the center of all productions. It is where new products are created. It is also tasked with keeping the company up to date in several fields, including production, consumer trends, and other domestic demands. Plus, it is no surprise that this unit is also where national and international standards for safety and durability are applied. It might be interesting to know that this company was a pioneer in setting standards through some of its products nationwide. Each year, this company evaluates the market to release the most recent product designs, giving it a competitive edge over other brands. Its massive production facilities can produce thousands of tons of products each year. As part of its future vision, this company is already expanding its facilities by launching a new production line. Once this new unit is up and running, it will add some 8,000 tons to its annual production. It also hopes to create its very own high-quality molds in the near future. This firm has overcome significant challenges over the years to enjoy its many achievements. Presently, this company is operating under its potential production capacity, and its ultimate goal is to use its full potential along the lines of exports.
Now, plastic is known as a group of synthetic or semi-synthetic materials created through the polymerization process. So, one of the most prominent ingredients in this mix is polymers, which are a derivative of petrochemical products that come from processing oil. It's not surprising that Iran has an ever-expanding polymer industry, given its large oil reserves.
We looked at some figures from the National Plastic and Polymer Industries Association. Data showed that the polymer industry gets most of its feedstock from domestic petrochemical complexes. Plus, there are some 8,000 production units that make plastic products nationwide. These units have a total capacity to produce roughly 13 million tons annually. Some $3.3 billion worth of polymer products were exported last year. That's according to the National Plastic and Polymer Industries Association. Furthermore, it says these exports registered a 23% increase compared to the year before. The association also says exports in this sector make up roughly 7% of the country's non-oil exports. Iran's oil and petrochemical industries are subject to US-imposed sanctions. Still, the wide variety of their products and high international demand has kept the market floating. On a broader scale, switching attention to added value products to boost non-oil exports has been a transformative move for Iranian industries. Through this, the country has tapped into its advanced domestic capabilities and diversified its economy toward a knowledge-based one. Household appliances are universal and an integral part of our modern daily life. Nearly all households have some sort of appliance meant to bring ease and comfort to everyday domestic tasks. Additionally, these items assist us in preserving and preparing food, cleaning our clothes, and overall helping us stay healthy. In general, the near 100% penetration of appliances in homes shows how crucial they are for our way of life and just how abundantly available these items are.
This week, we will journey through Iran's massive home appliance industry. We wanted to see how this sector has developed over the years and check out some major players in this manufacturing arena.
To become more familiar with this sector, we decided to visit Steel Alborz Industries. It was established 30 years ago and has since become a well-known household brand. This company began its work by producing steel sinks. Later, it added to its product basket and began manufacturing stoves, ovens, stovetop ventilation systems, and taps, among other kitchen attachments. With two factories in Shiraz and one in the capital Tehran, its production facilities can make hundreds of thousands of units annually in over 200 different models. One of these factories is solely dedicated to various molds needed to create its stylishly modern products. Early on in its manufacturing journey, this company used to import steel stencil sheets from Europe. But after becoming a subsidiary of the second largest producer of galvanized steel sheets, it began purchasing most of its raw material domestically. The company uses the latest technology to manufacture its products. Its production lines are equipped with cutting-edge automated assembly systems managed by experienced staff. None the less important is the use of high-quality raw materials and strong sustainable designs are two key components in guaranteeing the long life of these kitchen appliances.
Here is a short word on the machines used in manufacturing home appliances in Iran. Many production machines and automated systems, such as steel laser cutters, are domestically produced. Of course, that's not to say all of them are locally made. Some still need to be imported, but it is noteworthy just how much of this equipment is already available in domestic markets.
Research and development and quality control are critical activities of this manufacturing company. The R&D department is responsible for developing new products as well as monitoring the market and customers' needs. Its quality control division is built into its production facilities. Here, items are frequently checked and tested with the latest technologies to ensure manufacturing uniformity. As you might know, this also guarantees that each item is made exactly the same, which increases the quality of the final product. The R&D and quality control departments are also responsible for implementing national and international standards, which led the way for its exports. Currently, this company not only distributes its products nationwide, but also sends its items to neighboring and Eurasian markets. This company largely attributes its success to its highly experienced and specialized staff who are in charge of various production processes. On the whole, it has created numerous job opportunities directly and indirectly. Plus, it has dozens of representative agencies across the country. Like many in the home appliance industry, this company has faced many obstacles throughout the years. But its trump card has been its unique approach to solving these challenges. For example, the US-imposed sanctions were one that this company transformed into a domestic opportunity.
Now, Iran domestically produces a lot of raw materials needed in this sector, which spares local manufacturers from spending millions on imports. What's more, domestically supplying raw materials to the home appliance industry has helped it blossom. But you don't have to take my word for it. Here's an overview of the sector and its productions, including some insight into raw materials produced in Iran.
Iran is the 10th largest steel producer in the world, just behind Brazil. However, China is the undisputed producer with nearly 100 million tons of monthly output. That's just to give you an idea of how large the country's steel sector is. It's undoubtedly important, as the country's mammoth industry feeds numerous down-the-line sectors, including home appliance manufacturing. The World Steel Association's figures show that major Iranian steel mills produced nearly 30 million tons of crude steel and products last year. It might be interesting to know that over 30% of total productions are typically exported, generating millions in foreign revenue. But that's not the only industry that supplies raw materials to the home appliance sector. Petrochemical products, such as polymers, which are used to make plastic, also contribute to the production of home appliances. Iran's Home Appliances Manufacturers Union says some 15 million household appliances were produced in the country last year. That's far beyond the original production target of 12 million units set by the government. Meanwhile, Iran exports many of these products to neighboring regions, including Asia and Africa. Last year, the total value of exports was over $300 million, according to Iran's Trade Promotion Organization. All things considered, there is a lot to look forward to regarding Iran's expanding home appliance sector.
Okay, I shall now step aside for several minutes and let my good friend and colleague guide you on an educational adventure out on the field. Take it away.
Most of you have probably thought about biking to work, or biking to most places for that matter, instead of driving. You get a little workout done in your probably sedentary lifestyle, you help the environment, you don't pay for fuel during a global energy crisis, and well, frankly, you look cool. but you never actually got to doing it, or you did it a couple times and realized that it's not for you. Maybe it was too difficult. Maybe you were burned out halfway through and had to take a taxi for the rest of the way, or that you showed up too sweaty for work. If you're still, however, interested in the idea, just not so much the problems, electric bikes are just the thing for you. And just why do I say that? Well, let's imagine you are biking to work and you find yourself burned out, or you get a bad cramp and you can't pedal the bike the rest of the way. So here are your options. You take a taxi and leave the bike, which is not really an option. You go back home hoping you were less than halfway to your destination, otherwise it would be even more difficult to do that. Or wait a good while till your energy level comes back up and miss work a little bit. None of these are elegant options, really. There is one, though. You have an electric bike, so you either don't even pedal at all for the rest of the way and just use the throttle on your electric bike, or you have the bike assist your pedaling so it's not as difficult and draining. You still get a workout done, but you're not drained completely afterwards. When he said 80% of the electronic kits are made in-house, it meant that pretty much the only thing that isn't being made here is the battery test kits and the LCDs they install on the bike handles that show you your current speed, wattage used by the motor, battery level, etc. And even that has a custom software. The 500, 750 and 1000 watt motors are made in-house and are installed in the way that you are seeing right now. Regular bikes from different brands and manufacturers are taken into the facilities and then they are prepped to have everything installed on them. There are lots of types for bikes, and for each bike with its purpose, they might use a different battery capacity and motor. For example, they use a 1000 watt motor and 64 cell battery on their biggest and baddest fat bike meant for rough off-road terrain, and a 500 watt motor and a 52 cell battery for their urban bikes that don't benefit too much from the extra horsepower. I mean, it's not actually horsepower, but you know what I mean. The process that goes behind turning mundane regular bikes that are great for a workout to one that is not as good for a workout, but is a lot more convenient and a lot more capable of transporting you from one place to another. So first, they need to cut some holes into the chassis, precision holes into these oftentimes aluminum chassis, to make room for the connections between the controller as well as the throttle on the handle and the battery pack. So once they have installed, now it's time for the electric motor, which is going to be installed on the rim. So they take the rim off. They disassemble all of the spokes on the rim. They reinstall it on the electric motor. But there's a crucial step here. They need to make sure that the screws of the spokes that are connected to the rim as well as the electric motor are completely balanced, so that the rim doesn't skew to one side or the other. So they spin it to make sure it doesn't touch two screws on both sides. If it does touch it and there's friction, they need to re-tighten or re-loosen some of the screws to make sure it's completely balanced. And now, which is designed for the 500 watt electric motor, this is the entire system with the battery pack installed and the controller also attached, as well as the throttle. But there's also another cool thing about this particular display and this whole system, but I'll reserve that for just a few minutes after we talk to one of the people behind this project to give us a little bit more information.
As an engineer and environmental enthusiast, I've always looked for a product to simultaneously save the health of the people and save the environment. And that's why I started a company called EVTech to manufacture electric bicycles in Iran. Currently, we are the largest e-bike manufacturer in Iran, and our bikes are tailor-made to Iranian trains. And people can use them here in our mountainous cities like Tehran easily. Our bikes are ranging from fat bikes, mountain bikes, and city bikes, and have different motors with different output powers. So you can choose from our products based on your need and your applications. At the core, we are a company that mainly manufacture power electronic components of e-bikes and electric motorcycles. We are manufacturing power electronics chargers, power electronic e-bike controllers, and also design brushless DC motors that have been used in our products and electric motors that manufactured by other companies. We also manufacture our battery packs and use very, very sophisticated battery management systems to ensure that our batteries are working in their ideal conditions and are safe to use in everyday basis.
This is the last bit of information that I said I'd be talking about before. So the bike has its regular set of gears. You got the back gears and the front gears. But then there is display, and with this number that shows a assistive gear, let's call it. So when the number is on zero, when you pedal for like one round, it doesn't assist you at all. But as the number goes up, it assists you more and more. So if you pedal the same amount and the number is on like three, it pushes you a lot further than if this number was set to zero. This is great for those times when you feel like you're really burned out and you can't pedal that much, especially when you're in an upward slope. So you increase this number, you get more assistance from the electric motor to push yourself forward a lot more. Now it's time for me to take it for a quick little spin. So this throttle is the difference between enjoying bike riding and not so much enjoying it and looking at it as a chore and just a workout. I have been like one of the people that I mentioned at the beginning of the program, the type that wants to bike to more places but doesn't do it because I find myself burned out too quickly when I'm going up a slope. With this, I can enjoy the flat surfaces and the downward slopes in biking, which are a lot more enjoyable than the upward slopes, and just skip the difficult slopes. So I'm seriously considering getting one of these electric bikes myself. And with that, we have come to the end of the program. Until next week.
What an awesome report, as always. Many thanks. Well, that covers today's bazaar. I have been Samson Sees. Sees you in the next bazaar.
IRIB English Radio.